1981, side three of a series of interviews with Bernard Goodman. This is Lois Weaver speaking. We talked in our last session about your very extensive background in law, and specifically in the specialty of bankruptcy. And you talked about discrimination, really, that the Jewish lawyers faced. How did you feel about this? You said corporations did not hire Jewish lawyers. You practiced alone.
It personally did not bother me for a special reason. I came from a small town, Connellsville, and grew up with Christians all around me. I played with Christians, I danced with Christians, we went to school together, and I didn't have that feeling that I was something special, that I was different. It wasn't until I came to the University of Pittsburgh, I was all of 17, first acquaintance, you might say, with a big city, and was shocked. I was only on the campus a short time when a Connellsville man, who was a couple of years ahead of me in college, said to me, "Barney, you know, they have fraternities here, and a lot of them do not take Jewish boys, and ours is one of them, so I won't say too much of you, but there are a couple of Jewish fraternities. There's the Pi Lambda Phi, there's a Phi Epsilon Pi, and they're both good fraternities, and you'll find friends among them." It was a shocking experience. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wait until Friday afternoon, when I usually took a train back to Connellsville. I just felt hurt. The first time I'd ever run into what I won't call it anti-Semitism as such, but discrimination.
I was separate
and apart. And I started to act accordingly. In other words, I realized that I could only go in certain directions so far when I'm going to run into it again. And that was my beginning. So that when I first started to practice law, I didn't expect anything different. I wasn't shocked by it at that point. I had learned to live with it. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, I got along. And frankly, throughout my entire career as a lawyer, I've had nothing except goodwill from all the lawyers at the bar, particularly from the large firms, the so-called exclusive firms. They couldn't be nicer. And have shown it. So I can't I can't say that I was hurt by this situation. I just knew that it was there. And when I first started to practice law, and I would say to my senior associate, Mr. Alpern, when I was just working for him, how come there's no large Jewish law firms? He said, "Well, basically, I guess because they're rugged individualists and don't want to share with the others." And he says, they just never got together and say, "Well, we're going to form a firm." And see, everybody wanted to be on their own, and they struggled. And there's an intense rivalry and some jealousy and envy. That I never ran into. And I say my relations with the non-Jews at the bar has always been pleasant, and they have been very decent, so far as I'm concerned, nice to me.
Do they refer cases to you?
Oh, yes. Yes, 99% of my business comes from non-Jewish lawyers, mm-hmm, and non-Jewish firms, including the largest.
So, in other words, in your particular case, you established yourself, and you more or less became an authority in the field.
No, that's correct.
And the fact that you were Jewish didn't stand in your way with other lawyers.
No. For example, I was invited to become a member of the Pittsburgh Rotary Club. I was the only Jewish lawyer in the club for a good many years. And similarly, with the Bar Association, non-Jews nominated me for various offices up as high as vice president of the Bar Association. I voluntarily stepped down and didn't go to go on to become president of the Bar Association. But I have never had any feeling that I was being put upon in any way, shape, or form.
Now, did I understand you to say you had an opportunity to become president of the Bar
Association? Oh, yes.
But you didn't want it.
Two things happened. One, I was nominated for the executive committee of the Bar Association, which was then ran the whole show. And there are three of us that tied for last place. No, I'm wrong. Three of us nominated for the executive committee from maybe to about 10 vacancies and about 15 nominees. Emissary, we'll call him, for Lewis Kaplan, who was one of the three nominated, came to me and asked me if I would drop out, that Jewish boys, with too many of them running, they wouldn't have a chance. There was also a third nominee, who's still practicing law, by the way, and who just verified this past week to me. We were sitting on the bus together. We started talking about the old days. He is the who runs the office of Judge Broski of Superior Court. Abe Fingold.
Very, oh, I've heard the name.
Very capable lawyer. And I said, okay, I will be glad to drop out in favor of Lewis Kaplan. And then he went to see Fingold, and Fingold told them, and then told this emissary, and then told me, that he said, we'll drop out in a minute for you, Barney Goodman, because you've been very nice to the boys at the bar, the Jewish boys, but this is off the record, you might say, but Lewis Kaplan never lifted a finger to help anyone.
Yeah.
And became chairman, the first and only Jewish chairman of the Executive Committee of the Bar Association, to this day.
Is that right?
That's right. And at the end of that year, Vincent Burke, who later became president of the Bar Association, nominated me for vice president. The same thing happened as happened before. Lewis Kaplan had the Bar Association for the balance of the term. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, he moved up to vice president and then to president.
Mm-hmm.
When he was nominated for president, I was nominated for vice president. Again, the same emissary came to me about withdrawing because of the two Jews running for the top office of the Bar Association. You know, the Gentiles are going to find fault with this, and they're going to gang up. So again, this time I went out to see Vince Burke, who then lived out on Reynolds Street, later moved to Fox Chapel, and I told Vince the story, and I said, I'd like to have permission to withdraw. You had nominated me, and I felt I owed you this duty. He tried to talk me out. He said, there's nothing to it, Barney. Forget about it. I said, no. I said, listen, there's a personal situation here, and you come from a minority group. You're a Catholic, and I'm a Jew, and I would appreciate it if you would agree to withdraw the nominations. He says, okay, finally. And I did withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
And off the record again, Lewis Kaplan had no opposition.
Oh, my.
So all the great things they say about Lewis Kaplan,
had different personal experiences.
Oh, yes, and I can relate a few others in that same connection, but it isn't worthwhile. But that's it. But I say
you had more problems with lawyers within the faith than on the other side.
Yeah, no question about it. Now, back in the 30s, they had what they call the consent verdict scandal in Pittsburgh. The city solicitor, his name was Church Mahard. He was a real playboy. His father had been a judge up in Crawford County, left him like $1 million. He played, had the horses and what have you, lived in Swickley. He became a city solicitor in the Democratic administration, maybe the first administration, possibly. And there came reports, people started talking about the consent verdicts that the city of Pittsburgh was agreeing to, and it was costing the taxpayers, one judge, Judge Ralph Smith Sr., the father of the present Ralph Smith judge, He said, about spending about $1,000 a minute around here anymore, the city of Pittsburgh. And I was was on the committee of the Common Pleas Court, known as the Committee on Offenses, appointed by the president of the Bar Association, president of the court. And it was Judge, that was W.W. Stoner. Mm-hmm. And we had to hold all the hearings. And that's it. And then later on, some years later, there was a Blue Ribbon Committee appointed, some charges against some members of the bar. And I was called by the president, Judge McNocker, to serve on this committee. And I said, Judge, I served all through the 30s. I had all those heartaches and headaches. And I think I had enough of it. He said, do me a favor. He says, I've talked to Malcolm Anderson, the U.S. attorney. He's willing to serve. I'd like you to serve. I said, okay. So I served and actually wrote the last opinion of that committee before the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania took it all over under this, what they call this disciplinary committee.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But I wrote the last opinion in that situation. We retired at that point. So I served my stint in the Bar Association. Although just yesterday, my secretary cleaning my files because we're moving our office next week, came across a couple of matters and said, are you interested in these? And I looked at it, and one was a letter of commendation from the president judge of the federal bar thanking me for the work I had done in connection with the Rules Committee of the federal court. The referee in bankruptcy and myself wrote all the rules for the bankruptcy court. That was quite a few years ago. And I served on many committees of the Bar Association. I was active. But then I got active at about the same time, a little bit later, after my first wife passed away, Betty Ann's mother, in the Jewish Home for the Aged.
Well, now I want to hear about that. Why, you told me during our last session that you were widowed, you were still in your 40s, very young in your
40s. Oh, yes.
And you could have had your choice of any volunteer activity. Why did you pick that one?
Well, searching my memory, I would say I knew that my father was an out-of-town representative of the Jewish home. Every small town had somebody who was on a board such as that. And I remember that Rabbi Ashinsky would come to Connellsville, and my father would take him around to the various Jewish merchants and places and get 25 cents here, 50 cents there, a dollar there. And I can tell you this much, when I told my father that I had become was on the board of the Home for the Aged, tears came to his eyes, and he was very happy.
Because it was his value, and you were perpetuating.
That's right. And I just worked along there and became, started moving up to different...
Was the home at Brown's Hill at that time?
Oh, yes.
It was.
Yes, and Eddie Scheinberg, a lawyer, was the president at that time. It was back around 1944, maybe.
Well, you became president.
I eventually became president in 1958, served a couple of years. And it was during that period that not only did we pay off the entire indebtedness of the home, we had no indebtedness at all, but we had an endowment fund. And
were you partially responsible for originating that endowment fund?
Well, yes, I would say as part, not totally responsible at all. I think the great workers in those days at the home were fellows like Sidney Stark Sr., who's passed away, Feinberg. Herman Feinberg, great, Sam Carden.
Well, did all these men, did they eventually become president of the home?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Matter of fact, both Carden and Feinberg were ahead of me as president. And so Sidney Stark never became president. He just ran the show in many respects.
Behind the scenes?
Yes, he was a very dominant figure. But generous and a nice guy, and his children, Bill Stark, William Stark. But it was at that time that I got the idea that I saw too many elderly people come in because they had no place to go. Families couldn't handle them, couldn't take them. They were living in third-floor attics of large homes in Squirrel Hill. And saw how quickly they deteriorated in the presence of living with old, sick people.
At the home.
At the home. Uh-huh. And there must be some answer to this problem. And we came up with the idea we had all this ground with all these houses on the perimeter of the home grounds. Mm-hmm. And we owned those homes, most of them. And why not do something about it? We could tear down those houses and put up a structure. And we took it up with the UJF. And I recall that Herman Feinberg and Saul Weisberg of the UJF and myself went to Washington on several occasions. We met with David Lawrence, the former mayor of Pittsburgh, later governor of Pennsylvania. He was very wonderful to us and taking us to the right agency to get a grant.
Which at that time was what? Do you recall the name of the agency?
What's the one that was here in Pittsburgh, the housing set of...
HUD?
HUD.
Urban Development?
I think so. It's my reckon. I can't think of the man's name. I think he's in Harrisburg now.
These agencies change.
Yes, that's right. But anyway, we were able to get the loan we needed. We contributed the ground, and we organized the new corporation to handle this, and we laid down the law so far. We were concerned at least one half of the board had to be from the home board, and the other half could be selected by the UJF. Mm-hmm. And I think that carried through to today.
When actually did you break ground for the building?
I would say around 61, 62, somewhere in there. And I was elected president of the Riverview Apartments. As a matter of fact, I named the Riverview Apartment because it right overlooked the Monongahela River. Mm-hmm. And I served for 16 years as president of this.
Oh, really? I didn't realize you had been in that building.
And I just resigned. I didn't resign. I just stepped down 3 or 4 years ago and they've had different presidents since then.
That was a rather forward-thinking concept see people deteriorating in a home for the aged and to think of something like the Riverview Apartments where the well and... alone, elderly could live.
Yeah, we made certain regulations. For example, if a person or a couple could go into Riverview Apartments, it was the number one building, and we built the second structure. It was so popular, we had a waiting list of hundreds, that if in the event they reached a point where they couldn't take care of themselves, you had to be able to take care of yourself. We only served one meal, which the new one, which is now on Forward Avenue, does not serve. We served the evening meal. Mm-hmm. And
do they still serve the evening meal there?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And the understanding that if the person couldn't take care of themselves, that we would have room for them at all times at the home for the aged if they wanted to go there. We would always have a bed available, and that's still the rule. Mm-hmm. So actually what happens today, I was up the Monday of this week to the monthly board meeting.
You're still active there then?
I'm on the board, yes. I'm on the board. I'm a life trustee at the Home for the Aged. I'm on the board of the, one of the representatives from the Home for the Aged on the board of the Riverview Apartments. The secretary read the number of people who had passed away or some who had no longer able to take care of themselves had now moved into the Home for the Aged. So that still works.
What is the... minimum age for admittance to Riverview Apartments.
And that's
seems to be moving down every time I look at a retirement village. It's slowing
I think offhand my recollection is like 65, but I think there's exceptions or something.
Somebody ill. But
unable to, just couldn't function at the home. And a few of them who left the home moved down there because they were able to take care of themselves. They had a place to go and didn't need the home. Mm-hmm. So it opened up the doors for more people who needed the home, room for them. Now, we have the new wing now that's just going to have a few more beds and more or less office. There's so much paperwork anymore with all these agencies.
Oh, yes.
And they have a large deficit at the home now.
They do.
Oh, tremendous deficit, probably $1 million a year.
This deficit, I guess it's been climbing.
Been climbing because no matter, they don't get enough money from the state of Pennsylvania for the one, because very few of them were able to pay the rate. The rate as of the 1st of March of this year is now $1,550 per month. Now, how many people can afford to pay $1,550? And no longer is
what
a matter...
What was it when you first became active?
A few $100s a month. And it's gradually climbed and climbed and climbed. Till now, as of the 1st of March, it jumped from $1,400 to $1,550.
Oh, my heavens.
And it's really something, because the state of Pennsylvania did not give them enough. They lose, even at the present rate, I would say they lose maybe $6,000 a year in everyone in the home. The costs, because they're unionized. We were one of I will say that the Home for the Aged is the only unionized organization in Pittsburgh so far as the Jews are concerned that I know of. The hospital is not, because they could stand a strike, a picketing, because the doctor could schedule the emergency for next week. So it's a prostate, it's hemorrhoid, whatever it may be. It can wait another week or two. At the Riverview, where are they going to go? Where would they go? Could you tell the family to take the person out and let them have no families? What can we do with them? And the volunteer workers, and by the way, I must stress the fact that we've been told we're the most dedicated board in Pittsburgh, and the ladies' auxiliary there is absolutely wonderful.
They couldn't function without the volunteers.
No. And they became afraid to cross the picket lines because people take these pickets, go take their license number, and first thing you know, they'd be around their husband's place of business or what have you, and you know, could have trouble, and they were afraid. So we took the union, and every time the contract expires, they shoot for more and more money, and we don't get any more money from the state. And it's just been a rough situation.
Well, what percentage of people over there pay nothing or pay a very small...
I would say the great percentage of them. I don't think there's 20% pay the
$1,550. But that's actually what it costs. What actually costs more?
Yes. And our rates are more or less fixed by what the state gives us. Mm-hmm. And when they jumped from $1,400 to $1,550 as of March the 1st, I don't know how the people are going to take care of it.
And what about, for the future with the cutback in funds? That's going to affect the home, the Reagan administration philosophy.
It depends on the state. Unless the state comes through, you know, they're supposed to be helping the elderly also. And they talk about, you know, we can ride transportation free at certain hours. And they talk about if they get a larger sales tax on gasoline, some of that money will go to help the elderly. I don't know what the future holds. All I know is that the home, for the first time, has made some kind of arrangement with the UJF to borrow money. I think it must be a mortgage on the home property for the first time. I shudder at what the future holds, because in this economy we're now going through, experiencing, it doesn't add up in my book. I have in my pocket, this is off the record, I have a sister in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm glad I thought of this, because I have to give it to Betty Ann. She's been taking care of it. But these are the problems that you have. And
how much of a waiting list do you have over there now?
Frankly, at the moment, I don't know, but it's overwhelming. They've purposely been trying to cut down at the home, except the very needy cases. They've been trying to hold them out as long as possible, let the families take care of them, because of the tremendous cost to the family.
Well, how do the families feel about this?
Well,
they don't like it.
They can't like it, and there's no compulsion under the law now. It formerly was the law that if a person couldn't pay and didn't pay, you could go to the children and you could go into court and force them to pay. We never did that. We never went into court at the home. But the law's been changed. You can't do that any longer.
Is that right?
That's right.
You mean a child is not responsible?
No, child is no longer responsible.
When did that happen?
Oh, I would say 4 or 5 years ago.
Whose idea was that?
I don't know. It's the state. I don't know how it was accomplished, but it's on the books. I don't know whether it's on the federal agency or what it is, but they no longer can be compelled.
How do you feel about that?
Well, what we've been doing, this is off the record, we send for the family and say, what can you contribute to the home? Not in the way of maintenance, but as a contribution to the home that we can use for general purposes.
And then it's deductible to them.
And you can make it, it's in the nature of a contribution to the home. It's not a support charge.
Mm-hmm.
And Saul Rubin, who's retired from business, you know Saul?
Yeah, sure, he does in my building.
That's right. Very decent guy. Mm-hmm. And very, he's first vice president of the home and would be the president, should have been by this time, but Joe Rubenstein's been hanging on because of this financial distress we were in and trying to work something out. And he heads that committee and meets every Sunday with families they're sent for. When they come in there, I mean, somebody's coming into the home. All right, we'll take them in, but you tell us you don't have anything or they can only pay so much to Social Security. We can take that. But what can you give us in the way of a contribution to the home to help us out? That's the situation.
It's rough.
Yes, it is. It's very rough.
You've been really active there all these years, so it's really been, has this been your major volunteerism, would you say?
Yes, definitely so. It's like 35 years or something like that. Started in like 1945.
You were, at that time, how old?
46.
So,
That's a long time.
From your middle years.
Yes, that's right. Again, off the record, we'll say, you know, the kosher, everything's kosher there.
Well, but
you can't bring any food in there.
But it is our only facility.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter whether you're Reformed or
anyway,
you are. I mean, if you...
That's right.
But what you're saying is the culture of the home.
That's right. The question about, in other words, what I'm saying is that when I first became a member of Concordia Club, and mostly, we'll say, German Jews are so-called, and for a Orthodox home, it was not in their sphere. They didn't know anything about the Jewish home for the aged. And it was always had it maintained its autonomy. That's why it never became a beneficiary of the home of the UJF. Never became a beneficiary. Never got a dime from the UJF.
Uh-huh.
People everywhere, hundreds of times I've had to tell them, we don't get a dime from the UJF. Don't tell me that you make your contribution. The home is separate and apart.
I'm going to turn this off.